Welcome to the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. I'm your host, James Renford Powell, author of the Renford Books and of the Laws of Material Wealth series. It's now a book, a workbook, 4 DVDs, 54 lessons, and 54 radio shows here on this show, covering each one of those lessons. And we'll be talking about a wide variety of things now that we've completed those 54 weeks. My guest this evening will be Joshua, and Joshua has been on the show before, and I'll give you more information about Joshua after the reading of the Renford Revelation tonight. He has been on the show. He is based from New Zealand. He's originally from Venezuela, but he lives in what we call the Embassy of Peace in New Zealand, and he's a world traveler. So we'll get to know him and talk to him a bit more with Joshua a little later in the show. Keep in mind that if you've got anybody who would like to listen to the show and possibly on the road or don't have access to a computer, you can call in on 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment of my guest Joshua or myself, you can do that by simply pressing the 1 button on your touch-tone dial, and that will flag me to bring you in for your comment or for your question. So we'll get on with the reading of the Renford Revelations blog tonight. Hopefully you've been going to www.iam-cor.org. /blog and viewing the Renford Revelations there, and you can make your comments about them or ask questions about them and so forth. And I expect my guest tonight to address some of the issues that are covered in the Renford Revelations. Tonight's Renford Revelation is called Self-Realization, a Verifiable Process. And mostly we have a lot of hocus-pocus and mysterious and waving of the arms about self-realization, but self-realization takes a specific course, and I'm calling it a verifiable process. We either make a conscious decision as to where to focus our time and energy, or we simply follow a traditional path, which causes no ripple of concern with family and friends. Some may be brave enough to strike out on their own as searchers, but wander around from one religion to another over many years. Almost always, they are asked to have faith in someone or in ideas they cannot verify. There can be no more important work than the process of self-discovery, because such knowledge defines us. This is literally the canvas upon which we paint our lives. Many of my articles and books specifically address the necessary process of identifying and verifying the universal laws in our life experiences, because all other subjects, disciplines, and endeavors originate from understanding the universal principles. You can accept a tradition, it seems everyone has one, or you can verify yourself that these laws are in play. What you can't verify can simply be left on the shelf until you can do so, or you can discard it for good. Because each universal principle is like a diamond with many facets, the learning experience continues for a lifetime. There may be an infinite number of facets for each universal law, because the laws are literally aspects of God or the creative, by whatever name you are comfortable with. You cannot find God out in the wild blue yonder, though he be omnipresent and there as well as everywhere else. You cannot find God in the churches, synagogues, mosques, and temples, even though without doubt he is there as well. We cannot even describe abstract terms without bringing them down to our level of understanding. We can attach to these abstract terms, such as truth, beauty, and goodness, a thing, such as what we can say is, this is a beautiful woman, or that is a good man, or this is a truthful statement. These are abstracts. That is as close as we can come. How could we possibly define the infinite with any true degree of understanding without injecting a lot of flowery tradition with no meaning? How can we seriously approach this desire for understanding of the infinite? We can do so by looking within. We can look at the universal laws reflected in our life experiences and here and there recognize some facet of one of the universal laws. Continue the process until all 13 principles have been identified and verified, even if it is only one simple facet each. Once this process is accomplished, even on this simple basis, the intuitive mind takes over, and everywhere you look, another facet will pop out for you from seemingly nowhere. Why is this process of identifying and verifying the universal laws so important? Most boys in America grow up with some early understanding of football, baseball, or basketball. If we're not gifted and don't play these games, we still have a rudimentary understanding of them. Can you imagine going to a football game without knowing the rules of the game? We do have immigrants, and they are homegrown Americans that don't know the game. But assume for a moment that you are going to a football game for the first time. You're way up in the stands, and down below is a manicured lawn with a bunch of lines with some big guys knocking each other down, lining up and firing out with a funny-shaped ball, being thrown, kicked, and protected in a headlong flight to get nowhere. Without the rules of the game, it makes no sense. As soon as you know the rules, it makes all the sense in the world, whether you like the game or not. It is the rules that define the game. It's the rules that make it football. Change the rules and you have a different game. If you do not know the rules of the game of life, that's what I refer to as the universal laws, you are just as lost as the first-time visitor to the football game. Identify and verify the rules of the game of life, and you will never be walking down the street moaning, "Woe is me." You do not have to take my word for it. In fact, I insist that you do not take my word at face value. You must identify and verify these principles for yourself. I can give you some idea by relating my experience, but until you do this for yourself, you will not have internalized these truths. They must be yours. The universal laws are verifiable. The second important aspect is that if you have identified and verified the universal laws in your life experience, every time you listen to a speaker, a television evangelist, a seminar or workshop speaker, read a book, or read a white paper, you will know whether they know or not. You will immediately recognize doctrines and dogmas for what they are, unverified tradition. If you are a mechanic or a financial expert, it will not take 3 minutes of conversation with someone trying to pass themselves off as an expert in your field. You will know. Why? Because you've been there and done that. You simply know. This simply puts you in a different category from almost anyone and everyone you know. What happens to those who know the rules of the game of life? You can live in the world with your friends and acquaintances. You do not want to become holier than thou or a know-it-all. You do not want to be a nuisance and talk about the subject where everyone with you wants to talk about it or not. What should be important to us is what we know. It is important to share what we have come to know, if there are those who are open to what we can share. However, the great value is in what we do with this knowledge in our lives. Your knowledge and presence will be recognized by those who it is important that they recognize. Some make fun of Jesus and ask, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" Others jeered, "Is this not the carpenter's son?" At the same time, it was noted, he speaks as one who has authority and not as a scribe. When you hear somebody talking about something, they know. His words ring true with authority. I have with me, that's my Renford revelation for this evening. I have someone with me tonight that I think you'll find speaks as one who has authority and someone that knows. Joshua visited Memphis in 2003, he has been on several of the Laws of Material Wealth show. We've interviewed him on core concepts, which anyone can go up tonight after the show. You can go to youtube.com, type in Renford Broadcast Network, and you can find shows with Joshua as the guest. Joshua is a world traveler. He's born of a Jewish mother in Egypt, and then he's with the family left when they were dispersed. He ended up in Venezuela and was raised there by his grandmother. He is a world, as I said, a world traveler. He works from a large farm in New Zealand called the Embassy of Peace. The director of that Embassy of Peace is with him tonight also, Callie, from New Zealand. They're visiting at the moment and are in Oakland, California. They will be spending some time there and in San Diego and in Tampa. And hopefully they'll pop back into Memphis for a little visit with us here with the Institute of Applied Metaphysics. Welcome to the show, Joshua. Good to have you back.
Thank you, James. It's nice to hear you again, and it's great to see how this event happened today in one of those meaningful moments of our conversations without expecting it. Just, I just want to thank you also, Tom Perkins, even though he couldn't make it to the program. He was the main guest speaker tonight.
And that's whatever right. Brother was Tom, for him, Brother Tom Perkins will be rescheduled. He is on the way back to Memphis and was not able to appear on the show tonight. I thank you for reminding me of that, Joshua. Tom is a retired Methodist minister and former vice president of Mid-Continent Bible College in Grace County, Kentucky, and he's been head of the inner city ministries near the Pyramid in Memphis, Tennessee. And is the author of Gems from a County Gravel Pit. The Gospel According to Pap is the name of the book. So we'll have him back on. We'll reschedule him as soon as we can. But it was very synchronistic that I was talking with Joshua a few minutes before I found out that Tom couldn't make it, and we were able to arrange for Joshua to be on the show. Where do your travels take you this time, Joshua?
Well, this time it took me from New Zealand, from the farm where we live, Freedom Farms, where the Embassy of Peace is, and Callie, who is a mother of three daughters and a wife to Stevie, was telling me, I think we need to go to the United States. And I've just been thinking, yeah. Just like an hour or two ago before she actually uttered those words, that what's calling me back to here, to this land. And I knew I had to visit a really good friend, Nathan Schulman, whom I'm staying with. He's been a brother to me since I met him in Bali. It's a kind man, a lovely person, and he's an acupuncturist. So I had to visit him. But one of the main reasons I wanted to visit him also was to visit two people, John and Kathy, which I haven't seen for maybe 13 years or 12 years or more. I don't keep track. But I met him for 4 days in their homes, and they always stayed in my heart. So I kept on saying to Nathan, when I come to California, I would love to visit Kathy and John. And it didn't happen. The flow didn't take us there. But this time, Kathy said, I'm buying tickets for San Diego, and that's where they live. I said, yep, no, I'm coming. So it's 3 months. We're going to be 3 months traveling all over the West Coast, and maybe I'll have to jump to the East Coast for other things. And then we're going to Hawaii for a month. That seems to be the journey at the moment. You know, things may change, and we accommodate whatever God's will is every day. And since I came here, I also, the other day in New Zealand, people were saying, oh, I think it seems you should contact James again. I said, yeah, I've been thinking of James for a while. That's when I called you, and then I arrived to the United States and immediately called you to tell you I was here, and that's today. And so that happened again. So we are on the show just out of nowhere, you know, just out of nothingness, something happened. And that's how I live. I live like that since I was a young man. As you said, my grandmother and mother were born in Egypt. And they had to leave Egypt because King Farouk was kicked out of power by Nasser, and the Jewish people were asked to leave. And without that story, we'll have to wait for another interview. But what I want to tell you is that my grandparents ended up in Venezuela, And they didn't know if they're going to see their children again, three uncles and one, my mom, a daughter. And but one by one, they started to show up without the internet or anything like that, or Facebook. It was a long time ago, in the late 50s. And they started to show along the years. And my father, George, who was a Texan lawyer from Welsh ancestry mainly, ended up going to Venezuela to do his business with the oil industry or something like that, some contracts he used to manage and or take care of. And then he met my grandmother, who was secretary on the law firm that he used to work. So that's how miraculously they met. I was born in Texas, the United States, and at the age of 3 months, I was taken to Venezuela, where I grew up. So that's basically a little bit of my journey from childhood, from my ancestors who are from Egyptian Jewish origin, back Matatiahu Cohen Levi, that goes from mom's side, from grandmom's side, back to maybe King David or all those people. And my dad's side is more of a Welsh Protestant background, ex-Protestant. He was very humorous, free thinker, and God-loving person, but he walked away from the traditional paths of Christianity or institutionalized religion more than, let's say Christianity, because Christianity is bad. There are so many denominations, and there are people who are mystical Christians in different places, or Coptic Christians, let's say the Protestant path, and married my mother, who also was more of a free thinker, who didn't go too much to synagogues, but loved God and loved people. And that's how Jessica, my sister, and I came into existence. And after that, from the second marriage of mom, Diana, Moses, Moshe came into existence. So that's basically, what happened in my family. And after I went to school in Venezuela, and I had my university degrees in systems engineering and basically operations research and applied mathematics and decision analysis to the oil industry in Venezuela and the banking system. With the mathematical models, we were seeing at one stage that the Venezuelan economy was going to collapse. And we put that in writing for the president of the central bank on those days, a long time ago, in 1992, more or less, I think. And or three. And then after a while of thinking the process of Venezuela, I said to God, why am I so blessed and there's so much pain in the world? Didn't make any sense to me that being such a wealthy nation in terms of the warmth and the beautiful people that live there and the resources of the land, which are so abundantly, we would have so much poverty and chaos and crime. And I understood deeply, the process of colonization, which I pondered so many times on it, and how very few families have created this amount of wealth, and majority of people were growing poor in the slums of Caracas and other cities. And since the days of university, I had a vision on how this will grow dramatically, the poverty, and it will, the middle class will shrink. It was sort of a vision driving. And that vision drove me to write a mathematical model to explain that somehow in terms of finances and economics, and with the hope that bankers and industrial people from industries and academics and people, who were more capable of understanding and managing situations will understand and will do something about it. But then I had to go to my own apartment and rethink things and meditate on why it was so hard for people to come, to be kind to one another and to care for the people who are not their direct bloodline or their direct family. And after sharing with my partners in business and some of the people that I was consulting, with a lot of compassion in my heart, and sometimes, I had to sit with things that I didn't want to hear, but I realized that it was not necessarily human beings who were going to act kindly in 3 hours. It would take something for people to change. And those ones who were willing to act sometimes were scared to talk. And those ones who were willing to act, and were not scared to talk. When they talk, they had to, you know, face all the criticisms of society. So seeing that, I went to my apartment and I said, well, I would like to know what is my next move, because I would like to participate in bringing peace to this earth. And after a set of meaningful events, God showed me very clearly that I had to close all my businesses and walk like the prophets of old. And I did so. I told my parents and my grandparents and my mom and my brothers and sisters and immediate friends and partners. And since they knew me, those ones who were close to me, not those ones who knew me just, you know, from a little social event or anything like that, but the close friends of mine and my partners who knew me really well knew that that was for real. And if I said so, it must have been true, because I had a really good relationship with all of them, and I had a relationship of integrity with every one of my partners. So somehow, within the, you know, the discomforts of a person who is so loved by his grandmother and family, having to close everything, sort of what people would call a successful material life. And for my partners, who we were doing a good work on not only on financially we were doing good, but a good work on society, trying to warn people that we should come back to real love for the people instead of looking after only few pockets of wealth, and trying to defend that and under, you know, bringing a deeper understanding. They all supported me and said, well, if it's coming from you, go for it, because we know something good will come out of that. But that had to wait for a long time, because I disappeared for years to New Zealand and walked the land by myself quietly and walked the whole country for a year, more or less visiting people in their homes, in their families, and then connecting them after a while, you know, in a journey which today has brought together a very, you know, significant number of friends all over the world. And that was completely done in faith. I closed businesses. I didn't have funds to fund me all these journeys. I just walked in faith, and day by day, things happened. So since I am born a Jewish woman, and for us the call from the Jewish, I'm not talking the Jewish religion, because there are many denominations as there are in Christianity, but the Israelite nation's call, and we have to understand very clearly that the ancient Israelite nation and their descendants are very, very much connected genetically and spiritually somehow, but they're not necessarily known to each other and known to the world. The ten tribes of Israel intermingled with most of the world by now. And the Jewish people who live in Israel and the Jewish people who live outside of Israel, known, recorded in synagogues or in the Jewish records, were supposed to be 25,000 million, more or less. But I didn't see that this was so. So I had to go to Venezuela and explain to South America that in radio stations, like this program and universities, and that actually the remnant of the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin, with some of the Levites, most of them were in South America, Portugal and Spain. And they were genetically connected to this people of ancient Judah through direct bloodlines that were lost in Inquisition and in the times that the king and queen of Spain said to the people, the Jewish people, that they had to leave Spain, and they had to journey through Europe, through Holland, some of the people, and there are records in synagogues, and then they had to go to Curaçao, which were some colonies, and then they ended up in Venezuela. And they were people who are associated with orchestrating later on tearing down the kingdoms, both in the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the South American Revolution. So what happened to the people of the Jewish people in Spain on a letter answering the edicts of the king, a family, a person called Abravanel, who claimed to be the king of Israel of that hour, who was in silence, but who had to talk because of the situation, answered the kings of Spain and the queen of Spain and the king of Spain, explaining them that if they did that to those people on those days, Spain will also be remember as a bad nation that changed, and then the consequences will be that someday people will kick them out or tear them down. And I look at history and those wheels of causes and effects, and the people said to me, how do you know in Venezuela that we're Jewish? And I said, well, in the family name, if you look at all these family names like Suarez, Perez, you know, Viso, Diaz, and so on, those family names are of Jewish origin, are of Hebrew origin, of biblical origin, and they are part of the family names the Inquisition forced into conversion into Catholicism, and they used to call them the Marranos, the pigs. And when I started to talk like that, I said, this is nothing against my beloved Catholic friends or Christian friends of Venezuela. It's the way it was. And I think it's time that people should have a choice to know what is the real roots, and if they want to reconnect with Rabbi Yeshua ben Yosef, who people in this age call Jesus Christ, Rabbi Yeshua ben Yosef was a Jewish rabbi, one of many rabbis of that time, which was a very connected, righteous soul who became the mouthpiece of God for his time and inspired to these people for his time. And I ask, you know, publicly that the records will be released somehow, that Spain or the Vatican should keep the records of these family names. And a little bit later, after 2010, those records were released somehow. I don't know if it was the direct consequence of my talk or it was one of these other synchronicities, but I guess a little bit of both. And there were 5,000 family names published, and those 5,000 family names, I'll say, cover most of the phone books of South America. I mean, 80% or 70% or 60%. Well, if that's so, and those are the genealogies of Judah, those are around, I don't, maybe a billion people of Christians, and a, you know, a portion, a great portion of them are Catholic in South America. Let's say the 300 million direct descendants now to those family names have been found. So that would say, if we talk about all social contracts and we make the Bible be, you know, a contract of all, which gives the right, the chutzpah, to the Jewish people to live in the land of Israel as a custodian of the 10 tribes come together with the two tribes as the prophecies are laid out, then if that's a lawful document, the Torah, the Bible, then we should embrace the prophecies as part of the lawful truths that are written there, whether they are in metaphor or literally, that we should aspire to know the truth. And so that land, according to Moses, was divided in camps for the 12 tribes. And all the prophets of Israel speak until Yeshua of the reunion of the tribes of Israel eventually, including John's revelations in Patmos, which states clearly that the Messiah of Israel is coming with 12,000 of each tribe. And in Jeremiah, where it's written that God will write his law in the hearts and minds of the children of Israel, both the house of Israel and the house of Judah, when they are reunited, and bring them to be a light unto all nations, as it's written in Genesis, house of priests and priestesses. So the question is, who are these people? Who are the people? Now we know there are probably 200 million people in South America which are Jewish. You cannot put 200 million people in the land of Israel, but I think it's too small. But anyway, they have the same right to live there. So today you cannot live in Israel being Jewish, you know, for good for all your life. You have to become an Israeli citizen. And here we come to a really interesting situation. Who are these descendants or these people who are going to awake spiritually in the world by direct revelation from God without having to be part of any particular line or Jewish or Christians? They're just, let's say, a genetic spiritual process of awakening and correction, which happens by the grace of God and maybe delayed or promoted by the genetic makeup and the neural makeup of each individual and their environments, whether they were in violent environments or peaceful environments when they grew up, etc. But how they grew up, how they awaken to this truth in their hearts, and how they become a nation unto God outside of all nations, outside of all jurisdictions of nation states or religious institutions, and how they go as peacemakers or as in modern days we could say peace ambassadors appointed not by a body like the United Nations or any kind of national recognition, but peace ambassadors appointed directly by the Creator in their hearts and minds. And so when we talk about this and we explore that this possibility is for real, there are three things in the modern days that we should address or articulate, at least to appeal to the rational mind of people, because those ones who know in their hearts the truth of God, when they hear it, they will know it. And that's been always the case. It's connected to what you were reading just before the program. For those ones who know, it's enough. And the other question is, how will we detect, how will we know the ambassadors of peace, or those ones who have the light of God like Yeshua, Jesus, has? They are the manifestation, the embodiment of pure spiritual values. Well, by their actions you shall know them. That's nothing new under the sun. It's not by title or by genealogy or by race or gender or affiliation. It's by their actions and their ministry, which sometimes doesn't even carry the word ministry. It just carries the word actions of kindness or whatever people know how to speak in their own language in let's say, education process. So the question is, well, if these people are there and they're growing as children and they are spiritually awakening to become ambassadors of peace, is society going to help them? Is society going to allow them to endeavor into this honorable path of being peaceful people, mediating discord and anger between people who haven't achieved this kind of peace in their hearts? And when we look at this situation, well, it's a very unfortunate one, but a challenge and an opportunity to bring to the understanding of people, both scientifically and lawfully, under the law, and through new revelations, new revelatory processes, which are counted by people who have revelations, and their example of life shows that they are actually holy, they are godly, they are living in the modern world, that they are godly. And so these three things are pillars which would support society to make this transformation. Scientific research towards what constitutes spiritual values instead of behavioral values and the differences between them, and hence, you know, how does the brain of a prophet and the heart of a prophet interact to perceive reality in a different manner, and how we distinguish scientifically, if it's possible, signs and symptoms in brains which allow us to discern between a self-centered person proclaiming him or herself to be a prophet or a prophetess or a bodhisattva in a Buddhist tradition or a Hindu yogi, and how we distinguish that from a self-centered person and a prophet or a prophetess, and how, because both sides talk about the same words, but not necessarily both brains work the same. The brain of a prophet has some hallmarks like a peace that surpasses all understanding, or even when people are suffering, they have goodness in them. That should somehow, or perhaps somehow, shows in symptoms and signs. So there are things scientifically that we can undertake to tell the difference between the two. The question is, which paradigm in science allow us to research such a thing? And there were no paradigms which will allow us to research spiritual values in distinction with behavioral values, good reward and fear conditioning values, because simply our science in the last 60 years, up to recently, the last 10 years or so, has been very reductionist and materialistic, and it's achieved some good things, but it to the expense of others. Which also puts us in a situation as a planet where governments, like the government of this nation, separated the affairs of church from state. The affairs from church, the separation was not to mean that people should become robots in their own office, because people are offices of government truly when they're spiritually equipped to minister in such an office. So it was not to become robots of a system. It was to actually do not give some kind of privileges to the people who were part of the church, the Christian church, but to treat everybody the same. And that didn't mean that we shouldn't spirituality. It just meant that we shouldn't favor any kind of religious group, that the state and the government should treat everybody the same. And so after understanding all that and looking at the situation in the world and hearing so many insights and revelations, personally, I had to articulate this also in law. And part of the Brain of Melchizedek, the thesis I wrote, was to actually put this, the paradigm to research scientifically on spiritual values and also to start to frame what constitutes sovereignty. And I didn't have to go too far. Sovereignty under God's law, it's given by God. God gives you the sovereignty to be an ambassador of his government, so to speak, for the order of peace, love in the world. And if we go not too far in time, I mean, if you read the Declaration of Independence of the United States, well, this nation was put together by a group of fathers and mothers whom thought that we had unalienable rights given by God, and that freedom and equality and peace and harmony and happiness should be the hallmarks of the manifestation of these unalienable rights. And so the question is, who are the sovereign people in the world? And because if you ought to be an ambassador of God's spirit or an ambassador of peace, you have to have a form of sovereignty, and a form of sovereignty which is based on peace and love for all creatures equally. You have to manifest those fruits to all creatures. You cannot work with swords or with guns or with weapons to actually breed peace, because this is not the fruits of peace. And when we started to, you know, so many people in the world who are participating in this dialogue and process started to understand that most people were actually in the world living under republics which were not real republics. They were under, let's say, South American republics under the Vatican. And the Vatican, it's a kingdom. It's a state of its own. So any nation who claims to be a Catholic nation, it's under Roman law, under the Vatican's law of Catholicism. And much more if the preamble of the constitutions of those countries say we're a Catholic nation. And then we have the Commonwealth nations who are under the queen of those nations, in which every one of them are, many of them, independent states or kingdoms, like the Kingdom of New Zealand, the Kingdom of Australia, and so on, the Kingdom of England. So really, most of the people of those kingdoms are subjects to a queen. They are not sovereign beings. If they wanted to be ambassadors of peace under God's sovereignty, and they would like to declare themselves people who could travel in God's will to bring peace to the earth, they could not necessarily do it straightforward. Even some countries would not allow them to renounce their nationality if they didn't have another nationality, which is not the case of the United States. In the United States, a little bit more advanced on that. You know, you could renounce your nationality, and the advice that this government gives you is that if you do that, you should do that in a country where you can stay, because from then on, the United States cannot guarantee your protection, and that's fair enough, because now you are part of God's government and God's, you're representing peace. And if many people in the world wanted to represent peace, and they should awaken or would awaken, as it's written in old prophecies, not only biblical prophecies or the prophecies of the family of Israel, because I don't call them necessarily biblical, but the prophecies of ancient Israel, and but other prophecies of peace, like, you know, the Muslim world, the Hindu world, and so on. Those prophecies of peace are accompanied with people walking in God's sovereignty, in God's jurisdiction. The Hopi Indians, the people of Waitaha, or the people who are the line of Ruak Inanna and Ratana in New Zealand, the Maori people, or the people who ancient times foresaw the days of peace and hold on to that dream of peace, it would be very hard for those people, even if they had in their heart the sovereignty, to the eyes of the inheritance that we have with kingdoms and republics, to walk from nation to nation without a passport, without a nationality, without a religious affiliation, to be able to embody God's light and love for whoever God sends them in different places. And it is important to understand
what
that
is
for
the,
a person,
Joshua, how is the government of New Zealand dealing with the Embassy of Peace as you're developing there?
Well, the Embassy of Peace it's a benevolent, loving community of people and living organisms. So there's nothing really bad goodness in New Zealand between us and the people who have been interacting with the government of New Zealand. I mean, the government, the country of New Zealand, it's a lovely place. People are very peaceful most of the time. In every part of the country, to my eyes, the nation has balanced really well austerities with comfort so far. And I would say that many people are somehow working towards avoiding the overtaking of materialism over that nation. It's a nation who's managed to be still called God's own, both God's own and God's own. That's how they call it. And if you listen to the anthem of New Zealand, it's God of nations at thy feet in the bonds of love we need. There are parts of that anthem which says, people from all creed and race gather here before thy face, asking thee to bless this place. So it's an invocation to God's blessings to protect the nation. And the Maori people, which as far as I can see, are called the people of the land, Tangata Te Whenua, and the crown of the House of Windsor to Elizabeth holds a co-shared sovereignty to a treaty called the Treaties of Waitangi. And in that relationship, they've managed to keep a nation in peace. So for us to be in New Zealand, it's been a great privilege. I think people of New Zealand understand really well what we talk. I don't think there is any animosity about people being in peace and shining God's light. The problem is not that. The problem is we have inherited a body of statutes and acts and laws that sometimes modifying them to bring something greater, to accommodate something better, takes time. And that means that people as ambassadors of peace have to pay the price as perhaps prophets of old like Yeshua and Jesus and philosophers of old like Socrates had to pay the price. Thank God these days it's not crucifixions and harsh treatments. It's more like, okay, you have to leave the country and you cannot come back in, you know, for a while. And in the worst case scenario, it's an unjustified ban for 5 years just because you want to work altruistically. And those are the legalities of the acts and statutes. It's not the hearts, not even of the officers of the government. They have to deal with that and try to find ways to try to change that properly. Just remember in the Acts of Independence of the United States, when it's written something like, you know, government should not be changed by people. They've been working properly and doing their job unless, you know, it's exhausted the capacity to try to find remedies to injustice, and then the people are called to a higher level of responsibility and duty, which is to break away from the tyrant government. And I think it's the same now. The Embassy of Peace is not an activist movement or anything like that, challenging world structures. The Embassy of Peace is a genuine, godly group of people meeting each other all over the world. It's not an institutionalized religion or an institution. It's you and me right now. We are an Embassy of Peace. And you are an ambassador of peace, and you have an understanding of what that means to you. And so I have the same or similar understanding, or maybe some difference. We sit and talk, and we work for peace, not fight for peace. Fight for peace has no meaning to me. I don't think it has meaning to people like Yeshua Jesus neither, where, you know, clearly in his word he says, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword, and he forgives you and his enemies. And it's the same in the Psalms of King David. David struggles when he has to go to war, and he says, and God says, "Well, if hearken to my voice, I'll turn your enemies into your friends." So the whole idea of the greater ideal of that revelation from Genesis to Revelation is that we embody a greater grace, and we are able eventually to have that peace in us so that we can minister that peace to others so that eventually everyone turns to peace. That's the ideal dream. That's the transgenerational dream. And so in the essay that I wrote about together with Florian, a person who was born in Germany, lived in New Zealand, we stated really clearly the situation in terms of the political side of sovereignty and what is the difference between spiritual sovereignty and God's sovereignty and how they connect with each other, and brought to some form of call for accountability to the United States, the Vatican, and the modern state of Israel, which are basically my three genealogies. So when peace starts, it starts with me. I need to find peace first with God. Then, after I found peace with God and I have a direct relationship with God, and I, for a while, I can embody that and I see myself becoming stable in that peace, then I have to somehow support my home, my immediate family, my immediate friends, the country I was born or the country I grew up or the country my genealogy comes from. And that's what I've done, because I understand really well these three genealogies and the culture of Venezuela, and particularly the Catholic faith, because most of my friends were Catholic and I played football in Catholic schools while I was studying in Jewish schools. I had to address the situation and call all of my brothers and sisters to understand that the most precious dreams that we hold in our hearts are hindered by beliefs, not by knowledge. When we know the truth, it's liberating. When we stick to beliefs that separate us, then we become loyal to groups and we try to fight with our brothers to defend our partial loyalty to a form of group or religion or nation. And that's why I wrote the Embassy of Peace essay, to understand that if in this nation, my forefathers called this place the God Blessed United States of America, that should show up in fruits, in action. If my other ancestors called Israel a nation called by God, then we should understand as Jewish people that we're not the only Israelites, that Israelites are lost and called back home eventually by all prophets, and to be a nation outside of all nations, which is, and be a nation of Kohanim, of priests and priestesses, to all people to minister love. That's very different than the modern state of Israel. And I understand the fears of survival because I'm part of the Jewish family, but that's not a justification to walk away from being the peace in the world God's called us to be. And today, the irony is that a Jewish person cannot live in Israel until he becomes an Israeli if he or she wants to live there for good. And I don't, personally, I don't have any desire to become an Israeli person. I am of the line of Judah, called to be the light unto all nations, and that's what I want to embody for everybody. And that's sometimes
Joshua,
hard, because not everybody,
Joshua, we have a caller. Let me bring
sure.
him in for his question, okay?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Bring the person on.
You have a question for Joshua or a comment?
Yes, I do have a question. Joshua, this is Cecil, and my question is, how can you be at peace if you are an economic slave and have been since birth? And second question is, the truth can only make you free when you know the truth and what the truth is. If you're living in a society where the laws are set up to obscure from you the truth and keep you in darkness and to keep you as an economic slave, then what is the process for peace? I know peace begins within, but how does the organization that you're working with, how does that begin to address the issue of bringing people to peace and actually to sovereignty? In this country, they've made sovereignty a bad word, a negative word. When certain people use it, they use it as a label to stigmatize you, when in essence, sovereignty and sovereign right is actually God-given right. it is something that you're entitled to, you know.
Okay. So what's your name, by the way?
Cecil, again. I'm Cecil.
Oh, Cecil, how are you?
I'm excellent. And you?
Wonderful. Very good. Thank you, Cecil. So this is my answer to you, Cecil. First question. I think everybody has a design to be sensitive to God's call, eventually respond to it if people so choose. So when people are in a difficult situation, like being born in economical slavery in any country, in any nation, let's say, you know, any nation, as in ancient times, when injustices were done and people suffered, let's go back to Egypt, where the actually family of Jacob grew up. Israel was not born in Israel. Israel was born in a land, and his family grew up to become a nation in Egypt. And in their hearts, through Moshe and others, they knew they had to leave that land. And they did, and there was a great distress. But there was a time that they awakened to the call to break free from that slavery. And that was not necessarily done by propaganda or by, you know, sovereignty movements of protests in Egypt or anything like that. It was done because when the prophet spoke, or the people of peace or love within their families, within their homes, spoke and wondered about how they would overcome these difficult situations, they came to realize that through their fears and through their inadequacies of being all they can be, sovereign beings unto God, they had to make a move. And even Moshe, when he hears the burning bush in the form of a bush that doesn't burn, in that metaphor or that story, the voice of God, the voice of Yod Hei Vav Hei, or the voice of Elohim, or the voice of He I Am that I am speaking to him, he wonders, you know, how is he going to do that, because he hardly knows how to speak. He was so scared. So I understand that ignorance and fear can paralyze people, but there is a moment in people's life that they are awakened, they take the journey, and when they take the journey, the whole universe, designed by God to help them through the agencies of God's love and power and mercy and grace and wisdom, start to cooperate with the persons, and they find a way to break away. Now, that's ancient story. Let's bring it to modern days. Before I was born, the United States, today it's called the United States. Then it was called a group of friends talking about how they're going to break free from England, drafting the Declaration of Independence. They were going through moments, you know, if not worse, very similar, you know, in terms of legalities, I think very similar to what many people feel they're going in their own countries, willing to break free from their government and become peaceful beings, finding a place to live. And they had to go through similar fears with their own different contextual differences in different generations, and they did it. They created a movement which eventually catalyzed a nation which allows you and I to talk and have this conversation. Now, that can also be improved, and the world is sort of deteriorating in some ways and going forward in others. That which is deteriorating of the world and of society and of humanity, we can improve. And it might be that we will improve it by breaking free from nation states and becoming ambassadors of peace. And the question is, are we going to have the same kind of stamina to do that and to cross the Jordan of fears and feelings of inadequacies and have faith in God to make it happen? I am convinced that it will happen, because there are many people who are growing not only to understand that these kind of slaveries are taking over in the world, but to understand also that there is no way that we need to fight for our freedom, because the powers in place, you know, are too powerful to even fight. You cannot fight with drones. You cannot fight with armies when you're an ambassador of peace. You can only work for peace and articulate your peace and follow in the footsteps of all those ones who came before us to be the peace in the world, to be the light in the world, no matter what happened. That's a personal decision. It's not something that an organization can do. And the organization, or better said, the organism I belong to, it's not a legal institution or anything like that. It's a family of friends. You cannot call a family an organization. Well, you could, but it's not a certified organization. It's an organism. It's a living organism. And as you and I now are connecting again, we are part of that living organism. We are the Embassy of Peace. So the question is, how do we articulate that scientifically, lawfully, rationally, without having to go to fight or invoking the term sovereignty just to avoid paying a ticket? That doesn't make any sense. I'm not a sovereign being that, I'm able to ride a car. Ride a car without a license. That has no grounds to what I'm talking about. That's absolute surface sovereignty. That's more than called autonomy or doing what I want. Sovereignty, it's the presence that is able to articulate peace and justice through mercy. I'm a sovereign when I'm able to embody peace and truth and love and mercy and find remedies to unjust situations. And that has to do with injustice to the physical bodies, to the souls of people, to the psyches of people. So if I'm invoking being an ambassador of peace, it's for that, not for driving a boat from here to New Zealand without a license to do so and cross borders without. That's not the point. The point is I need to cross borders without passports because I don't want to be associated with nations that still hold on to warlike machineries to defend themselves. That's against my integrity. But I want to work for peace. I want to work for peace wherever God sends me. And that's a limitation. I cannot go to some countries with an American passport or a Venezuelan passport or any kind of passport that it's in war with those nations because they don't see me as a peace ambassador. They see me as a member of that nation. It's a short circuit of integrity. And I don't want to do that. I want to represent God's spirit, which is for everybody. And so I don't need to belong to the Christian church to do that neither, or to the Jewish faith. I can be a peaceful ambassador of peace.
And I understand what you're saying. But question even two? Even in that scenario that you just gave, where you were talking about the sovereign wanting to drive without a license and so forth, that right there is one of the misconceptions that is actually deliberately put forth into the public. Like, they want to get around licenses, this and that and the other, which you should, because you shouldn't have to have a license to do anything that is your God-given right to do. It is your God-given right to travel, period. And for somebody to then take what is your God-given right and then say, I've got to license you to do what God has already ordained for you to do.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have less than 60 seconds. And I have one other caller here. Demi is on the line. She wanted to say hello, Joshua.
Hi, Joshua.
Hey,
Demi.
How are you?
Nice
to hear you.
It's so good. I've got laryngitis. I've got a head cold, but it's so good to hear your voice. I thank God that he brought us together and give my love to Callie. And through you, I've met Jim, and I keep in touch with you through him. And good things are happening, and I want to be an ambassador of peace. And, God bless you and all of those beautiful people you're with all over the world. And it's just so good to hear your voice.
It's the same.
We're out of time, everyone. We're out of time. We're down to a matter of seconds. Thanks, everyone, for being
Thank
with
you.
Us on
I
the laws
you,
of material
Danny,
wealth.
I call you.
Thank you. And be with us again next
love
week.
Love you all. Yes,
for the laws
you,
of material wealth.
Thanks, James, for the beautiful
Thank
program
you,
in Cecil. I'll talk to you later about the same subject.
Sounds great.
Thank you. Bye.
Looking forward to it.
Bye.
Oh, awesome.
Yes.
Yep, I'm here.
And we are still on the air.
Are we still on the air?
Yes, we are.
Okay, it said 10 seconds, more than 10 seconds ago.
Okay,
so
well,
I thought
we are still rolling until the host
Please.
Disengages. We got a little extra time.
Okay,
all right.
Good. All right, well, thanks, everybody, for being with us. That was good, and we want you to come back on. We'll try to have some more frequently, so we'll have I'll schedule in where we don't already have some bookings, and where we can have continuation of this discussion, and invite all of you to go to iam-core.org/blog and make your comments, argue your points, whatever, positive or negative. We want to hear from you. And have a good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you, James. Thank you, Cecil. Until next time.